Football is back.
Aguero makes it three. Chelsea switch off at the back.
Like the rest of us returning to work, the Premier League is also back. Keep up to date with the latest scores on the OTB Sports app. Live updates and analysis of this summer's Premier League action. The OTB Sports app. Live score updates straight to your phone. The OTB Podcast Network. This is OTB Sports Radio. Alan Quinlan's How's the Head?
Hi all, Alan Quinlan here. Welcome to episode 2 of my chats during COVID-19 and the lockdown. I'm delighted to say that for episode 2, I'm joined by actor and comedian Pat Short. Pat, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. Good to see you.
Pat, obviously we know each other pretty well, but some people I know well, you don't really know. And that was the whole purpose, if that makes sense. Sometimes we don't know what's going on in each other's heads, even though, you know, you're close to your friends and all that stuff. It's really only just I wanted to have a general chat with you about your career and, you know, how you've been coping during lockdown, what kind of changes you've had to make and stuff like that. And that's the whole purpose of these conversations that I'm having with various different people. How has it been for you? Obviously, it's been so unsettling for everybody else, but for you personally and your family, what's it been like?
Well, it's been odd, I'd say. Like, I mean, it's been kind of like three different phases or four different phases. When it started, I was very, very busy. I was in the middle of a tour, near the end of it, and I was working on a production in Belfast at the same time, and everything stopped. So I was working so much, it almost felt, oh God, that was great to get a break. You know what I mean? So it was a bit of relief. And I'd say like a lot of people around the country, because it stopped suddenly, there's a sense of relief, a sense of, gosh, it's almost like a holiday for the first week or so. And then gradually it start, you know, the information comes out, you start to realize this could go on a while and we don't know what's going to come out. And but look, you know, it's still kind of, we're all a bit giddy, a bit odd and all the rest. And I think as the weeks went on, it started to dawn on everybody that this is something very, 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 very different. And then you start thinking about your own line of work, my own work and jobs I had on, and they weren't going to happen and they were cancelled. And you know, stuff being cancelled and stuff being moved, that, you know, that's fine. And we were moving shows and shifting stuff around and everything else. But then the dawning starts to realize none of us know when we're going to go back to work. And that's a place I've never been. I have to say, I was absolutely stopped in my tracks there a few weeks ago. I kind of had to, you know, in my business, you have to cope with lots of strange things, like you go for an audition or something, you don't get it. You think you're going to get it. You're convinced you're right for the part. You don't get it. It's a bit of rejection, a bit of ego bashing and all the rest. But you kind of go, okay, look, I get on with what it, you make excuses or whatever. This is very, very different because suddenly there's no work. There's nothing happening and it's completely out of your control. And that's
Did you get frustrated, Pat? Did it frustrate you to the point that certainly for me, like you said, first week or two is you're in a bit of shock, but I started to get frustrated by it because it's out of your control. You're losing work. You're thinking about the future, particularly if you're freelancing. Essentially, that's what both of us are doing, and that caused a fair bit of frustration and angst in me. How did that work with you?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say is I'm good at coping with stress. I'm good at coping with I suppose the uncertainty of life, because that's the nature of my business, like yourself, anyone freelancing, but also in the entertainment world, I presume the sporting world is not that far removed. You do cope, you get mechanisms to cope with stress and things like that, but this was totally different because you begin to realize, actually, God, it could be a year. And they're saying even, you know, you listen to news reports and stuff and they're saying, you might not be back for 2 years. It could be 5 years before they find the vaccine. How is things going to work? So I did get stressed. Yes, the answer to your question is for the first time in a long time, I got really, really stressed about work. Normally I would, you know, if things didn't work out for me, Alan, I could pick up the phone, ring around, book a theater, write a show, do something. Do you know what I mean? If I didn't get a film part or something like that, it's fine. So I kind of developed over the years. I'm long enough in the game to realize you create your own work. You push yourself. You do it yourself. But this was completely out of control. I, no matter what I would do, it's not creating the work. So it was difficult. Yeah, I do think it was very, very difficult. Funny enough, I've moved on from there because you go through stages, you know, and now I'm in a situation where, well, you know, it will come back eventually. And we now need to start looking at different areas and different ways of creating work. So even though it's not solved yet and the problems aren't gone away, I've taken a different approach to it and gone, okay, well, look, let's be positive about it and let's see what we can do to keep things going, you know.
I'm sure you're the same as myself. We certainly, being in the positions we're in, I count myself very lucky to play professional sport and be working in the media. Now, I'm sure you pinch yourself sometimes when it's all going well.
Yeah.
So we're not looking for any self-pity. There's lots of people out there, Pat, and you've been around the block. I mean that respectfully. You've been ups and downs. You're in your early 50s. You know, what would you say to someone who's kind of struggling and with that uncertainty that's surely affecting everybody right across the board? It isn't just as easy as be positive. Do people need to be creative, make contacts, try and find different things to do or look at different opportunities?
You've got to look at different opportunities and see how things will change, and it will be out of your control, and you won't necessarily know the next move, but you constantly got to be thinking about something different and reinventing yourself. So for example, you take inspiration from the strangest of places, Alan, and you know I drive motorbikes. I love motorbikes, and since I was a kid, I've been into motorbikes. So one night on YouTube, I was watching the story of Kawasaki or Suzuki. I can't remember which one it was. And the company was a looming company. They used to make looms for wool and making clothes, all that kind of stuff. And then the war happened, and that all fell asunder. So after the war, they realized there was a need for cheap transport, and they got into making motorbikes. So they went completely onto a different track. You know what I mean? And I thought that was interesting. I thought, yeah, well, look, this COVID-19 at the moment is a bit like a war scenario in the sense that it's just threw everything out the window. And we have to now kind of completely think differently about certain things. Use your talents and skills and ideas and all the rest, but you have to kind of think of something, maybe not as drastic as that, you know what I mean? But I found it interesting that they, like, such a big company, that they came from a completely different area, and they, when they needed to, they just changed tack. And it's a bit like that. I'm thinking now of looking towards online kind of shows and what can we do in that area, how to present that, how to do that, and how to make an income from it. You know what I mean? Now, I don't have any of the answers yet, but I'm looking into those areas. And I think it's going to be definitely a way that we have to operate in the future. So there you go. I'm completely in an unknown world. But, you know, I've got skill sets and knowledge, and I'll adapt and get on with it. So it's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy. And you get up every morning and you go to yourself, God, where are we going here? But we got to go on. We got to keep working. You got to keep moving and keep moving on. And that's it.
Yeah, I'm going to go back in reverse now, back to maybe start your career a little, because you mentioned the word inspiration now, finding inspiration. Who was your inspiration growing up to do what you've done and have the success that you've had in theatre, in movies, in music? Who inspired you and what made you thick as a young fella?
Nobody really, and I don't say that. I mean, I never intended to get into comedy and acting. I was a musician. I played saxophone, and I learned music when I was a kid, and I always wanted to get into a band. I was into art. Some of my family were great artists, so I went to art college, and I ended up meeting John Kenny, and that's how I started playing music with John, and John was doing comedy, and that's how I ended up coming into the performance, what I call the performance area. And so while I was doing comedy and performance with John, I really enjoyed it. I loved it. And then I began to realize, like, I was a huge fan of Neil Tobin, always, but never taught myself doing something like him. But when I found myself in the arena where I was doing work like Neil Tobin in the same circuit, I would have to say he was my, I loved what he did. I loved, and he was an interesting guy. He always called himself an actor, not a comedian. And I often sometimes feel the same, because I wouldn't be a stand-up comic. I do comedy through performance and stuff like that. So it's an odd one. I never
does
really
that mean ha- you're not funny.
That
you don't never tell jokes. You tell stories.
Well, somebody
characters.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody once described it, I thought quite well, is that you tell a joke through a character, through a story. Yeah. Which look, you do when you make people laugh. It doesn't matter how you get there. You know what I mean?
I was at one of your shows actually, in UL in the mid 90s, and I remember going, these guys are superstars, because everyone loved you. Everyone laughed at everything you said. Like, did you feel like a superstar? Did you think you had made it at that stage?
No.
What were you thinking?
No, it was funny, because we worked so hard, myself and John. And it was on to the next venue, on to the next gig, come up with the next show, tried to keep current. We both came from a music background. John had been in bands and I had been in bands. And
yeah, he played in Handy Pack at my graduation dance in 1991, I think. 1990 or 91, around then. Yeah. John was playing,
he would have been with a band called Gimmick. Actually way before that, and they did a lot of touring around Europe and England and everywhere, but they were all very young at the time. But no, the point is that we approached touring in theatres and everything like a band would be, doing gigs at weekends and that kind of stuff. So we were constantly working and didn't have time to sit back and think about it, but yet we had ideas, making films, videos, all that kind of stuff. And look, it was great. People tuned into what we were doing.
And it was a massive success, wasn't it?
Huge.
It was huge throughout that era. Yeah. The two of you, you know, you hopped off each other. People loved you. The video cassettes, yeah. I still have them at home. All the shows and stuff, they were incredible. Back in the 90s, when I was at these shows and they were selling out everywhere, was there an adrenaline rush with that? Did you hit the dressing room and high-five John and say, we nailed it? What was that like, that feeling for you, performance? Because I always think of it from my game, sport. You hit the dressing room, if you've done well, there's a real adrenaline rush. And that's sometimes why you do it, for that feeling, that buzz, that adrenaline. Maybe you get it out on the pitch as well. You get it out on the stage, I'm sure. But what was it like for you when you hit the dressing room?
Well, it was funny, because it would be different in sport. I mean, if you go out on the pitch for a match, every day is different, and if you have if you're up against a big team, and you're the underdog, and then you win by a margin, and you come in and go like, this is incredible, that you can, you know, feel. With us, it was kind of different, because you'd be doing the same show every night, and you'd be, you know, so when you knew what you were doing, I think those adrenaline rushes used to come when we were doing different countries, when we traveled abroad, and we were in different audiences. We weren't sure how they'd react.
Yes.
And that was kind of different when we toured America, when we toured all over Europe and down to Russia and all these places. That was when you came back into the dressing room going, Jesus, that was mad, you know. But when we toured Ireland, it was kind of work. It was full on. Only when you were doing a new show or a new performance or something like that, then you would have the rush, you know what I mean, that you're talking about. But no, it's very much once you get into a routine of a gig and everything else, you got to be sharp. You got to be on your game and doing your gig. But it's work, you know.
When you get to that level, Pat, of performance and nailing it, do you feel then that you've made it? You've got this right, and
I don't know.
You've made it as a kind of a star as such, because as I said, I know you. You don't view yourself as a star. You're a man of the people. You're always out and about chatting to people. But you have made it. You know, you do. If you're performing that front of that many people, you're in movies, surely you look at yourself and say, I have made it.
I don't know if you ever do. I don't know, because it's that kind of thing about insecurity of being self-employed and being an actor. Will I ever get another film? Will I ever walk across a 2,000-seater stage again, or 7,000-seat, or whatever it is? You know what I mean? Look, I do. Compared to, every so often I do recognize that. Like, my daughter's starting to be an actress at the moment. She's coming out of college and everything else. And I completely get it, that she doesn't have the recognition or anything that I have, and she's got to work hard for it like I did. And that's, I think then you realize, yeah, actually, it has, I have met it to a large degree. You know what I mean? If you ever, if that's what it means. But there's different degrees of that.
Okay, I wanna ask you, and we'll just get off the acting and stuff. Do you ever walk around with any shame that you've never played hurling for Tipperary, because you grew up beside the stadium, and I see the jersey in the background there as well. It's just a little reminder. Just tell us what that was like quickly, growing up in Thurles, Tipperary, all that kind of stuff.
Well, it's funny. I grew up in Thurles on Kickham Street, and the Rubber Dial, Tommy Dial, one of the most famous hurlers, just lived down the street. And so we had, like, Tipperary was a, Thurles was a bit like that. You had famous hurlers around the place, you know, everywhere. Rattler was up the road. Rattler Burns, you know, they were all around you. Yet there was something funny on our street, even though it was a load of lads, nobody played hurling. Nobody played for a club or anything. We didn't. And I think there was a bit of animosity towards the GA, because I remember when 1984, when there was the centenary of the GA, and I don't think the Rubber Dial, Tommy Dial, couldn't get a ticket for the match. Here's a guy that had massive amount of All-Ireland medals, played for Tipperary, gave up everything. He was a rock star back in the 50s or that time, you know what I mean? And that kind of disillusioned me and a lot of the lads on the street about it. I suppose when you're a kid too, there's a bit of anarchy in you and all the rest. So we did boxing, running, all sorts of other things. I've never played hurling, to be honest with you, a little bit in school.
But you did play in Semple Stadium though, didn't you?
I did, but I played the cornet. I played it more Munster finals than Nicky English, I'd say. I did. I played the trumpet in the cornet in the Thurles brass band. And I used to play all the big matches there all the time when I was a kid. So I was there all the time. I know, I love, don't get me wrong, I love hurling, and I'm a hurling fan, but it was a funny one. And I only found out recently my dad has an All-Ireland medal. So he only told us in the last year or two.
Jesus, that's a strange one. Found out recently. Yeah. Tell me, when you go and play in Kilkenny now, obviously there's massive rivalry between Tipperary and Kilkenny. And they mightn't love you as much in Kilkenny, do they, anymore, for certain videos you made in the last number of years. What has that reaction been like? And tell us the background to those videos.
Okay. It was coming up to an All-Ireland against Kilkenny, one of many, over the last while. And I was writing a new show in the studio. And we were just kind of, you know, taking, and I thought, look, we'll have a bit of crack. And I think I had a Skoda at the time, and Skoda were sponsoring Tipperary GA. So I came up with an idea of a bit of a laugh, drive over, you know, all the things you can do with a Skoda. You can pick up the kids, you can bring them everywhere else, and you can also drive over a Kilkenny jersey. And then there was another one with a coffin, because I had a coffin in the show, and we just draped a jersey over it, you know, VIP. But then
that was the end of Kilkenny in your view, yeah, that one.
Yeah, and look, it was a bit of fun. It was tongue-in-cheek. And then the most recent one with the jersey, well, that was the first two, you see. And then when it came to the All-Ireland recently with Kilkenny again, everyone was saying, you got to do something else. So myself and the young fella, Louis, went out the back with the dogs and the jersey. There was no dirt. There was no shite or not really. It was a bit of crack. And funny enough, on the day of the All-Ireland, I was up there with some friends of mine.
So you were scooping up a bit of dog poo.
That's it. Yes. Right. Sorry, I should explain it. I said, look, on the day, I love taking my dogs for a walk, but I won't be able to. But if anybody's up around the Croke Park area and you're walking dog, there'll be loads of these left around. So poop, clean up the scoop with a Kilkenny jersey, because Tipperary beat him. It was a bit of fun. And funny enough,
what was the reaction like?
It was
Kilkenny people, genuinely.
Genuinely, a lot, you know, look, you've diehard fans that thought it was sacrilegious to the jersey, but I didn't do anything. I just, it was acting. And then on the day of the match, I was up with some friends of mine and friends of yours, actually, at the match. And we sat with a load of Kilkenny guys who thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. So, you know, Kilkenny people have a sense of humor too. They know it's only tongue-in-cheek. And it's kind of like a tradition too, where all, whether it be Clare, Tipperary, I mean, always having a puck at each other and having a go at each other. And it's good-humoured banter is what I'd call it.
Do you think it costs you some ticket sales, though? You know, I'd be thinking if I did something now when I was playing for Munster against Leinster, that maybe it costs me some business or gigs or something like that. You didn't put any thought on it.
Do you know what? You can't think like that, because it's, you know, it's only a bit of fun, and I'd like to think that people would
see it for fun.
See it for what it is. I got sent a load of really funny ones. I thought they were hilarious. There was a woman in Kilkenny sent me a toilet roll that was made from Tipperary bunting.
Right, okay. So she was getting her back at it.
Yeah, I thought that was hilarious. So it kind of started a bit of banter and a bit of crack. There was absolutely no harm meant in it at all, but it was just a bit of fun.
This is OTB Sports Radio. Alan Quinlan's How's the Head?
Okay, we get back to the career now, Pat. Obviously, the Unbelievables were incredibly successful. Unfortunately, John got sick. He finished in 2000. Then you kind of had to go and reinvent yourself as a solo performer. So what was that like, trying to produce a whole show, write a show, do all the characters, running off stage, running on stage? It must have been way more difficult than having John with you, where you can kind of pop in and pop out.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. I started my career with John. So I'd never worked with anybody else. I'd never worked as a solo performer. So I found it extremely difficult. It took me about a year or two before I actually could go out on my own and do a show. Because I kind of thought, gosh, you know, that dynamic of the Unbelievables was so enormous. Me on my own, how will it work? So, yeah, I just got out and I kind of crafted a show that I thought would kind of, you know, I wrote the material with the Unbelievables. So that's what I wrote and done. So I did the same and tried to work it. And yeah, it was difficult, Alan. You know, it took me a long time to get, I suppose, into the headspace that this will work. You know what I mean? But it's what I do. And it's, you know, even if it wasn't successful, I'd still be doing it today because that's what I do, you know.
So the performance on stage is obviously where it started for you. Then you did various different roles and movies. You produced your own shows. What were the highlights for you of being on the screen now?
Well, being on screen, I've done quite a lot of movies and TV shows and everything else. Father Ted was one of the first TV shows I ever did. That was a blast. It was great fun. It was a low-budget TV show. It's huge all over the world, and people comment to me from all over the world, Australia, and everywhere I go about that character. So you'd have to kind of say that was a big one at the start, even though it took years to kind of come together, you know, because it took years to kind of build. But Garage, I suppose the movie would have to be in one of it was a great film, great director. I knew Lenny beforehand. We worked together. I knew Mark O'Halloran, who wrote it. And they had just done Adam and Paul. And I remember seeing Adam and Paul thinking, oh, my God, that's one of the most amazing films I've ever seen. Performances, it was written, it was amazing. And then they turned up at a gig in Vicar Street one night and said, look, Lenny said to me, look, I've got this film, Mark is writing it. And we'd love you to be in it. And we think you'd be demand for the role. And I thought, wow, can I get the script? He said, no, it's not written yet. We're writing it and putting it together. So it was great. And so I said, look, I'm in. Because after seeing the work they did and knowing the people involved, it was great. And then the script was sent on to me. And I went like, oh, my God. It was a beautiful script. But as an actor reading it, I was going, Jesus,
it's a big role, isn't it?
It's a big role.
It's dark as well.
Yeah, and I'd never... It's very dark in spots, and I'd never...
But it's an incredible movie, and I think I want to say that The Garage, I'm not just saying it to you, it's just an awesome movie, and I think you won an IFTA for it as well, so you got recognition.
Yeah. I won awards in various different places, countries for it, but It was a big role. I'd never done a lead role before. So that was, I thought, God, now you got to carry the movie. And that, you know, that's frightened the shite out of me. But it was a great story. It was a lovely, lovely story. And I really loved taking on the role of Josie because he was a character that's what made the movie. Well, look, in Ireland, certainly, everyone I've ever met has said to me, there was a guy like that in my village, in my town, in my city, in my local pub in the city, in our area. And everyone could identify with it. And that's an amazing thing.
Could you identify with it?
Oh, yeah.
Yourself? Yeah. I could. Yeah. And I probably all can, I suppose.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. I've met numerous guys. I mean, look, when you travel the country and play in bands and play in gigs, and like myself and John have done Antrages, there's people like that in a lot of venues around the country that are working menial jobs, and the community look after them. And a lot of people don't look after them, but it's an interesting one. And I thought Mark really, really, really did that story proud in telling that guy's story in the film, in the writing of it. You know, it was very, very moving.
And obviously there was other ones on screen as well. Man About Dog, you had a lesser role in that, but you did shoot the bull in the movie, didn't you?
I did, yeah. That was a funny movie. That was I enjoyed that that movie. It was great fun. The character. I was playing a traveller in that, and I ended up working with a bunch of travellers in that, travelling closely. Great guys, great family, and we had great crack at it. But yeah, it was a howl. It was a funny one.
I remember one time we walked up to O'Connell Street in Limerick, and there was a group of travellers there, and they saw you, made a beeline for you, followed you all around the streets. So you were attracting the travellers after that movie to you. They were, and you worked with so many of them. What was that like?
That was great. I mean, I always find a great energy in the travelling community. It's frightening. It's just this ball of energy coming at you. And that's what I try to recreate in the characters when I'm doing it, is just try and get that energy there into it, you know. And I remember I did a TV show with John Connors a while back, and I was promoting Who Do You Think You Are? And it was very funny. We're in the green room afterwards. He said, Jez, I can't wait to see that program. He said, my mother is mad to see it. I said, oh, Does she enjoy the program? No, she thinks there's a cut of a traveller in you.
There probably is a little bit.
Listen, no better
you
man.
You played the role so well.
Well, it's great. Look, as I said, I always enjoy the crack and with the working. I've worked with loads of travellers down through the years and had great fun working with them and great crack with them. So in that instance, yeah, absolutely. It was great crack.
How do you cope with the ups and downs? Does I always, again, it's something I think about myself, and I'm kind of intrigued talking to people who are in other sorts of performance. How do you cope with ups and downs? You have a good performance, bad performance, criticism, negativity. How does Pat Short deal with that? Or is it all roses and is it all fantastic all the time?
Of course not. Oh, God, look, there's so many different strands to that, Alan. If you have a bad performance, I think you know it's yourself, and you know the reasons for it, in the sense you didn't put enough in, you didn't work hard enough at it, you were distracted or whatever. But if you put in a good performance in something and you work hard at it, and then a critic comes along and knocks you down. When I was younger, it was soul destroying. What did I do wrong or whatever? But then I think there is certain critics that are good at their job. And I think when a critic knocks you down and does it and explains the reason why, you know, yeah, they're right, you know. But when somebody does it and doesn't know what they're talking about, I think then you kind of go, well, look, I don't agree with that. I think that's a load of bollocks or whatever. You know what I mean? And you cope with it, you know. But it can be soul destroying when you're young and when you're starting out in the business, because you eventually learn you never set out to do a bad show. You never set out to play a bad game. You never set out not to win or not to. You put everything into it normally, you know. So sometimes there's other reasons for bad reaction. You shouldn't beat yourself up over it, you know. And look, if we all, you know, it's a funny. I did a talk recently with a bunch of students in a film school, and they asked me, you know, one of their lecturers, a friend of mine, I'd worked with him, he directed me in a piece, and he asked me to come on and talk to him. So I was on, talking about film, talking about everything else. And one of the girls, a very interesting question, she says, you know, I can't remember exactly the way the question was, but it's kind of almost, do you ever doubt yourself in something or whatever, you know? And I said, you know, they were down the country, and I said, look, you have to be very proud of what you do as an actor. Number one, you're doing a very, very, very important job and a good job, and you're getting up there, you're entertaining people. Sometimes you can feel, especially down the country, that it's, you're not like, Jesus, I'm not in Dublin, I'm not in the big scene, I'm not hanging out with people, I'm not, it's very easy to feel like that, I'm not in the circle, and I'm not maybe that important and everything else. That's rubbish. You gotta be positive and proud about what you do. And sometimes when you get knocked down, well, that's part and parcel, and pick yourself up and get on with it and just keep doing what you do, because if you work hard enough at whatever you do, you will be good. You might not be everyone's cup of tea, but that doesn't mean you're not good at what you do. Do you know what I mean? So I really found it an interesting, I'd love to remember what she asked me, but it reminded me of when I was a kid back in Turles, trying to play jazz and thinking, oh, you're, geez, there's lads in Dublin, they're way better than me. I wouldn't have a hope of it. And actually, I was really good. But I didn't have that confidence because I was off down in the middle of nowhere and not mixing and mingling with other people. You know what I mean? And I got that from that kid, that she was kind of questioning herself about what she was doing, if you know what I mean. I know I've drifted a little bit away, Alan, but I think it's kind of...
100%, I agree. And I think it was probably one of the questions I was going to ask you. You're in your early 50s now. You've experienced all that stuff. You know, I'm out the other side of rugby. I sometimes wish what I know now, I wish I knew back then, that so much would be better for me, particularly, you know, with mistakes I made in the field and maybe training harder, all that kind of stuff. We want to tell our kids about all this thing. We tell them, get the best out of yourself. So it's difficult for young people, isn't it, to try and starting out on whatever journey they're on. The really good ones who make it quickly get that confidence and self-belief in themselves.
Yeah.
Does your confidence or self-belief ever waver? And do you worry? You know, what worries you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I was doing a job this week. I was asked to do something. I won't go into detail about it, but it was something completely different than what I'd normally do. And it was somebody asked me to help them out because they were stuck. And yet it was in the film kind of end of things. So I kind of directed something for them. And because there was a lot of important people involved, I really doubted myself halfway through. Christ, am I doing the right thing here? I'm putting myself up. I kind of said, yeah, I'll do that for you. And then a day or two later, I realized, shit, this is really important. And the decisions I've made in it, I'm putting myself out there in front of people in my own industry. And if this falls flat, I could, you know. So, yeah, even still, I'm still kind of going, crikey. And I think that happens when you put yourself out there. You do something different, which we all have to do. You finish playing rugby, you got to change tack and do something else because you're very young. Do you know what I mean, Alan? And you kind of doubt yourself and go, Christ, am I doing, am I really doing the right thing here? So I think you always doubt yourself. And that's a kind of a healthy energy that you need as well. Once you be positive about it, in a sense, you know, you have to keep looking back to what you've achieved and what you've done to kind of, I suppose, to kind of give you the strength to go on with what you're doing. And you should always stick your neck out because that's the only way you learn, you know.
Is there anything you change in your journey, Pat? You know, if you were the kid in the class that Pat Short was coming in talking to now, what would you do different? And what kind of advice would you give to yourself on your journey? Because it seems like a very strange question in a sense, because you've done incredibly well.
Yeah.
So was that, you know, maybe there's not much to change. Maybe you tweak things a little bit. I think I would change certain things about my approach. But the biggest thing I would change in myself is try and make myself mentally more stronger, more confident. I had a kind of natural talent and ability, but I had so many doubts. I still have them. I have them way more than the average person. And that's my challenge that I kind of have to deal with. What would you say to yourself, or what would you change, or would you change anything?
I wouldn't change anything, because I really felt I learned as I went along, if you know what I mean. So I think you do need that learning process. But the doubting, it took me a long time to get to that stage where I actually had, how would I put this, Alan? You kind of acknowledge how good you are. It's kind of an Irish trait in lots of ways. You know,
we're afraid to acknowledge it, in a sense.
Yeah. And you're also,
we kind of know, we know deep down, but we're afraid, because people,
there's a whole thing about putting up there and someone will go, oh, Jesus, cop yourself on. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like the Twitter thing. You know, Twitter at the moment, you say, Jesus, isn't it a lovely day? And you get a response, Jesus, lovely for you. I wish I was in your place. you know, it's ridiculous. Like, and it's having that confidence to go, it is a lovely day. You know, I'm using the wrong analogy, but yes, have a bit more confidence in yourself and a bit more. But I mean, that comes from working hard. If you work hard at whatever it is you do, well, then you should have the confidence, because you said, well, I put in the hours, I put in the work.
Yeah, but some people need probably more of a helping hand, don't they? So what I'm trying to say, if I'm talking to kids, is if you can't figure it out yourself, talk to someone. And it's the same as, is, you know, it's kind of directly, confidence and self-belief is directly linked to mental health in all of us.
Absolutely.
If our mental health is right, if we feel good, you know, we feel confident. Obviously, if you feel good in yourself, it's better than feeling bad in yourself. That's a very bland analogy there. But I think I always try and say to young people that if you're lacking that confidence and self-belief, talk to someone. Find a mentor. I asked you about a mentor, inspiration. You were lucky, you probably didn't need someone to kind of push you along, but sometimes young kids do, young sports people do, and I'm sure young actors and performers do. But that's what I would say. I don't know what you think of that, about finding a mentor and trying to, you know, get someone to guide him and help him, give him a bit of advice. Because I think as a society nowadays, we're much more open. In a sense, when you and I grew up, it was like, kick up the backside, get out and do it, you know, whatever that was. I think society's a little bit more open now, and there is more people out there. So I would say to young people, ask, find someone, find an inspiration, find someone who gives you a buzz and a lift, and ask them how they did it, and take the advice from fools like us who maybe are out the other side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in my case, desperation was a big part of it, Alan, because I left home very young, but I'd know there was so many of us in the family who didn't know where to go. So you had to make your own life. You had to carve your own future, if you know what I mean. And while it was tough and you took knocks and all the rest, you just had to get on with it. And I would love to have had a mentor in some respects around this, but then, I mean, you just did. I didn't have a choice but to kind of get out and work and get out and do whatever it was. And there was no option of failure. It's a kind of an odd one. And that sometimes there's a healthy side to that as well. You know, that's good. But if you do, if you're constantly doubting yourself, you need to get over that. I know that, it sounds very glib, but you know, you need to kind of sit back and check your positive sides and what you've done, which is good, and focus on that area and get on with it. Do you know what I mean? Genuinely just focus on the positive and get on. And if you have a mentor, it's great. But I really do think, you know, there's great things in every one of us. And if you just start looking for those things.
It's trying to find those, yeah. My whole point is sometimes it's hard to find and bring out that talent, whatever it is.
Absolutely.
The best bin man in the world, the best rugby player in the world, the best actor. it's trying to be the best you can be. And some of us find it better or harder or more difficult to get that stuff out. Speaking about your head and confidence and all that, have you ever kind of hit the wall in here and kind of gone, you know, aside from what's going on with your career, but that the head has wobbled a bit, because mental health is a really important part of, it's a really important part of any conversations I have, because I think one in five people will have be affected at some stage in their lives. And I think the more people in high profile positions to say, it's okay, it's acceptable. I may not have a mental health problem, but it's something that I have empathy for. How do you feel about that?
I do struggle, Alan, like everybody. And when it comes to writing a new show, for example, I'm bringing it back to work, but I'll explain myself why. When you, in my game, I stop a show after about 2 years or so, and I write a new show. And when I start putting that show together, I have no income, no nothing. I literally have to put this together in a few months, get it out on the road and start touring. But I've got a family. I've got kids to support. I've got to put them through schools and all sorts of things and everything else. And some days you'll be sitting there going, Jesus Christ, I've no idea. What am I doing? What am I doing to myself? So I started kind of, and it's kind of similar in what you're saying. Like you start doubting yourself. You start doubting your ability, no matter, you know. So I kind of have a way of deconstructing and breaking down and go looking at the positives, try not to take on too much in my head as to, you know, Jesus, what's going to pay the bills next month? What happens if the show doesn't work? What happens? You can start bombarding yourself with all sorts of negativity that will just get you into a place where you can't perform and you can't work and everything else. So I got to start breaking it down, deconstructing and saying, look, I'm not going to take on all of that at the moment, but we're having a, you know, you're having a, it probably comes easier to me being a writer in the sense that I remember when I started writing shows initially when I was a young fella, you'd look at a blank page and you go, oh Jesus, I can't write anything. You know, oh my God, there's not no ideas coming, because you're forcing yourself. You're constantly, you're building up anxiety. You're getting worked up and you're going, Jesus. So I learned there was a great phrase said to me is, don't try and get things right, just write it. Basically what they meant is you can edit, just start working, start putting it together, start writing. And the same approach I kind of take towards mental health in the sense of, don't try and fix everything immediately. Just take it step by step, little bits, little things, and you'll eventually work it all out. But if you try and take on, you're swamped, you're completely swamped if you start thinking of all the negative. So, because like when you start thinking negatively, it's a roller coaster. It starts building up, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And you find it hard to see the wood from the trees, and you find it hard to see anything other than, Jesus, this is the worst place ever I could be in my life. Actually, there's loads of great things around you, your family, your kids, you know. And you know what? I'll get that written tomorrow. I'll get that right tomorrow. I won't get it right tonight. I'll forget about it and move on. And it does. It always gets right. Do you know what I mean? While you seem like you're in the darkest place in the world in relation to your script writing and everything. And I'm talking about script writing, but I'm also talking about where you are.
No, that's your life. That's your life.
Yeah. But and it also is my career, which is my family, which is my livelihood, which is all the things that can make people go to a dark place, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, there's pressure.
Yes.
Everybody's experienced pressure, I think. And it's really what positive mental health is, how you deal with that pressure. Yeah. Some deal with it much better than others. And like the mentoring side of thing, I was nudging towards that a while ago.
Yeah.
Having good mentors and good people around you help you cope when you hit that wall and where you have those downs rather than the ups. But sometimes you need the mentor when we have the ups as well to keep us somewhere in the middle. And that's really important. And it's something I genuinely admire, your positive attitude. And I know it's not just being put on for here, because you've had your ups and downs. I certainly haven't dealt with my downs as well as I probably would have liked. And, you know, that's acceptable to me. That's fine with me now, because I've kind of opened up about all that kind of stuff. But I think it's really important. And that's why I mentioned the mental health side of this. So I do admire the positivity, and it makes perfect sense. You said recently, though, in an interview, that you can't look, you can't really look or look at yourself or listen to yourself. How is that? We have something in common there, because people often say to me about my commentaries or even some of the matches, I don't really look back at them. There's been a few on the last few weeks, and I've looked at some of them, but I've been kind of nervous. It's strange looking at yourself, isn't it, on the TV or on?
It's strange listening.
Why is that?
Well, I think, well, from my point of view, I think why I was talking about that is, look, we're always conscious of making an easier yourself. So we're all conscious of that. But also there's the technical aspect of it. When I'm doing a film or a TV show or something, I'm aware of the mistakes I'm making. The audience aren't. And I'm aware of, I could have done that better. I should have looked that way. I wasn't concentrating on that or something like, you know what I mean? So when
so you start critiquing yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Even in a good performance.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Maybe
you do.
That's part of it.
That's part of it. You know, that's why you work at what you do. So it sometimes often takes a year or so after a project that I can actually look at it, not remembering the problems and the things that I did that I would have liked to have done. Do you know what I mean? And I often like sit back. I think it came up recently with Killing the Scully being back on the air. There was lots of things I was like, you're working on television, fast paced. It's a great show. I love it. I'm very proud of it. But there's things in it that I thought, oh, I'd like to have done that. I'd like to have done that. And then sometimes there's things in it that I didn't like I was doing, but the audience love it. So, and you know, so you beat yourself up over things and it's unnecessary, you know.
Okay. We're nearly finished, Pat. I won't keep you much longer. And thank you so much for your time.
Oh, I'm delighted.
We touched a little bit on the start, but I'd like you just to kind of in kind of finishing off this chat is what's the plan now for you? Obviously, there's still a fair bit of the unknown, and what would you like to achieve for the rest of your days as a performer, as an actor? Because there's no, unlike a sports person who has to kind of stop and maybe mid 30s end it if they're lucky, you can kind of continue on. Mm. So where is it going from here for Pat Short?
Well, that's exactly, I think you just said it, continue on. I mean, I'd love to be able to do a few more films. I had a couple of films lined up at the end of this year. Hopefully we'll get to do them, the way things are going. I'd like to get back on the stage. I think after what's happened with this whole pandemic and COVID-19, there anything you took for granted, I think now you realize how amazing things were. So in my case, I'm touring all the time, doing great houses, having great fun, playing to great audiences. I just want that to go back to normal, you know? And I now really, really, really appreciate how good things were. So I'm looking forward to that getting back. And what the future has, I don't know, but I'm excited about it in lots of ways and looking to write, create and work in the industry that I'm in.
Okay. The highlights for me were The Unbelievables in the 90s, being at the shows. Although they were in the 2000s as well, so they weren't just completely finished. I was at some of your shows as well.
Yeah.
The Cripple of Inish Man, incredible. Went to see in London with That's Arthur, right. friend of ours, and The Garage, of course. It's just been incredible. So, Pat, thanks for joining me. It's always brilliant to chat to you, but in this capacity even better, because some people get to know you. I know you do a lot of interviews, may get to know you a little bit better. Thanks for joining me and good luck for the future.
Thanks, Alan. Good to talk to you.
Alan Quinlan's How's the Head on OTB. That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.